I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Andrew Forbes joins me now. He's just published a new book, Fieldwork, on baseball and making a living. It's a great collection of essays on baseball that reflect not just the rich history of the sport, but look at how it works on a variety of levels, from the major and minor leagues to the little league field that Mr. Forbes tends to as he coaches his kids season in and season out. The value of labor, not just on the field measured in statistics, is observed in the book, but the idea of what's work and what's play, as the game itself is played out, is reflected upon, making for such a worthwhile read. We talk about money and gambling, too. You don't have to be a baseball fan to enjoy this collection, because there are some memorable, larger-than-life characters that also play a part through the stories in the book. Andrew Forbes is the author of two previous collections of baseball writing, The Utility of Boredom and The Only Way is the Steady Way. He's also authored two short story collections, a novel and a novella. Visit andrewgforbes.com for more. This new book is published by Assembly Press. We spoke nearly 3 weeks ago with Andrew, joining me from Peterborough, Ontario. Please welcome to the Plante on Line program, Andrew Forbes. Mr. Forbes, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Happy to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. There seems, to me, as I'm reading the book, such a familiarity or ease in your writing. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, because it's about something that means a lot to you, not just, you know, it's obviously work and hard work at that to write, but it reads as though you enjoy telling us these stories as you're writing the essays in the book.
I do, yeah. No, you're right to pick up on that for sure. I think there's a couple things at play. One is, as you're suggesting, that I'm just happy to be telling these stories because I find them so interesting. And another is that this is my third nonfiction book about baseball, and I think I've gotten to the point where I'm pretty comfortable letting my guard down and just delivering a lot of it in plain speak, just like I would if I were sitting next to you telling a story.
Yeah, and there's obviously such memorable characters that you're telling us about. Some of them that we know, and some of them that are from your own life that we obviously don't know. Mm-hmm. But the way you weave some of these stories together is just marvelous to read as we go through the collection. The thing that struck me about baseball, and you know, I know a little bit about it, having watched it with my grandmother growing up, is you know, the rules of the game are pretty rigid. But there's this element that's room for interpretation that I just found fascinating. You illustrate this, the subjective element. When you tell the story about one of your sons, he gets waved off to first base even though he claims that the ball never hit him.
Yeah.
That's such a wonderful way to, because, I mean, if we asked him today, he'll probably still swear that the ball never hit him, right?
I think so, yeah.
What do you think it is about why people love baseball so much, and especially that element of the rules being as rigid as they are, and you know, every season, just as we're starting a new season now, you know, there's some new elements to it, and yet there's also great resistance to change.
Yeah, I think you're hitting it there. I think there's a great tension between the rules that we know we're supposed to follow, and I'm speaking about baseball, but of course it's much more broadly applicable to our lives. But,
yeah.
You know, baseball is it's a conservative game, it's a staid game, but within it there's a whole lot of innovation, and those innovations generally have to do with people reinterpreting rules that have been on the books for a long, long time, or deciding which rules are overlookable, in a sense, you know, and pushing to the point where they can, you know, as far as they can to get away with it before something is enforced. You know, in the news just these last few days are these new torpedo-shaped bats,
yeah,
which look like a cheat code to some people, but are perfectly within the rules. And it's a great example of, as I say, a game that's long been considered very conservative and unwilling to change, being confronted with a new interpretation of rules that have been on the books for decades.
Yes.
And the game will adjust. The pitchers will adjust. The game will adjust. So I think, you know, at heart, there's one of the things that I find most watchable about baseball and most intriguing about it is that tension between rules as they're interpreted and as they're actually written. You know, it's a game that actually encourages things like, you know, the theft of bases and things like that, right? So yeah, there's a great interplay between playing it straight and getting a little bit creative.
And as you illustrate in the book, you know, the part of this conservative view is how baseball viewed, say, gambling and people and players who gambled. Mm-hmm. And yet in the last few years, you know, we're inundated with betting on sports. You know, and I'll confess it, I dabble from time to time, even though I'm not really a sports fan, I just enjoy gambling. Yet, you know, baseball has had this, you know, moral stance on gambling, and yet the relationship between gambling and the league itself, you know, you watch the sports highlights on the news and they're giving you the odds. I think that would probably, if that was 100 years ago, I think people would be shocked at that.
I think if it was 10 years ago, people would be shocked at it. It's, yeah, that really is one of the more remarkable stories, I think, of the way that the game has changed. Its relationship, you know, it was an... Well, the fact of the matter is that baseball has long coexisted with and, in fact, in ways depended upon gambling for its very existence. It probably doesn't become... it probably doesn't become a profitable spectator sport without the interests of gamblers in the 19th century. That's where it goes from being something that people enjoy doing on a Sunday afternoon to something that people will actually pay to go and watch. And that's not my, that's not an original argument of mine. That's probably John Thorne, who's the official historian of Major League Baseball. He points that out. But the way that the game has tried so steadfastly over the century and a half that it's been an official entity to distance itself publicly from gambling, to all of a sudden, you know, really it comes down to a change in, I think it was an American Supreme, you know, U.S. Supreme Court case that allowed states to make these decisions about where, you know, sports gambling occurs, and states one after the other lined up to collect tax revenue off of it, so it became profitable for a lot more people and more easy to have out in the open, and to have it officially sanctioned. So now, as you say, you can't watch a sporting event, and baseball isn't alone in this. But baseball seems to be particularly bad at it without gambling being front and center, which is, you know, would come as a huge shock to all the baseball players in the past who face sanctions for being caught gambling.
Indeed. One of the themes throughout the book is the relationship between, say, the players and the game. The players, especially the owners, because that's key in terms of say, a lot of players over the years. I mean, you go to the Black Sox of, was it 1919? You know, they were always finding extra sources of money. And it surprised me as I was reading the book that it wasn't until, say, the mid-20th century where... a lot of players didn't have to say look for a second job off season or even during the season to supplement their income.
Yeah, it really is the ability to exist solely on a baseball salary for the vast majority of players. I mean, it was different if you were Babe Ruth, but really doesn't come about until you know, the 1970s when free agency becomes a factor in how baseball teams are constructed. Because before that, without getting too into the weeds, but before that, there was a rule called the reserve clause, which basically allowed an owner, once he'd signed you to an initial contract, to string you along for life until that owner decided that you were no longer useful and cut you loose. And in the meantime, basically set you know, your salary levels and would issue pay cuts if they weren't happy with your performance. So... yeah, the vast majority of players for the vast majority of the history of the game have required supplemental income. So, as I point out in the book, they've done some really interesting things, everything from, you know, appearing on stage to running their own mortuary business.
Yeah, you mentioned the 1970s. I guess that would have been at the start of the 70s, the one story you tell in the book about Curt Flood and fighting the reserve clause. And then you contrast that with... the recent contract of Shohei Ohtani. It's just fascinating how to consider the stories of those two people and the short span of time. I mean, that's about 50 years, isn't it? Or just over 50 years. Just how baseball has changed in that. And then, you know, the image of Flood, someone who is black, and then the rhetoric that, was used by both sides in that in that dispute. I mean, that evokes an America that, that's probably earlier than the 1970, doesn't it? I mean, it's shocking to even think about it now in 2025.
Yeah, it's hard to escape the feeling that so much of the vitriol that Curt Flood faced, I mean, this was a proud black baseball player in the late 1960s saying, you know, pay me what I'm worth. You can imagine the kind of public outcry that may have occasioned. But, and in fact, Flood didn't win his case, but his was kind of the first landmark. It really did kind of bring about a change in public perception of what ball players are worth. I mean, he famously used the phrase, he was a well-paid slave, which was incendiary, but not wrong. You know, if you look at, as I was saying, the way that players were treated and discarded at will by the people who ran baseball.
Yeah, and then he his career sort of ends at that point, doesn't it? I mean, he comes back for, what, is this a half a season or something like that?
Yeah, he got another kick at the can for one more. He had to sit out the following season, and he got another kick at the can. He agreed to have his contract traded to the Washington Senators, who were, you know, at that point a sad sack club. Well, for most of their existence, a bit of a sad sack club. And he'd been out of the game just too long. He was at an age where, you know, he would have had to have been training every day and playing regularly and just didn't have that opportunity while his case wound its way through courts. And when he came back, he wasn't the fleet center fielder, you know, good hitting fleet center fielder he'd been when the dispute began.
You know, you mentioned the Washington Senators just now, and you talked about what a sad sack team they're. You don't have to watch baseball to even know that. I mean, if you watch the movie Damn Yankees or the musical, I mean, you would know that already. And that's what I love about the book is that it reminds us of all these points in our say cultural consciousness. About what a part baseball plays. And I guess that's why baseball fans like yourself, you love baseball because there's that nostalgic element there, isn't there? I mean, you can follow baseball today, but you certainly have to know its history, don't you?
Well, I'm not, you know, I mean, that's how I view it. I think that, you know, there are as many different ways to enjoy and watch baseball as there are people who do that, but for me, certainly the nostalgia has a lot to do with it. The fact that I have the sense that when I'm watching people play baseball now, I'm, you know, effectively watching people in conversation with players from 150 years ago. But, you know, I do think that it's possible to enjoy the game just coming to it fresh. I think it's, you know, I think it's, especially as it's packaged now, I think it's exciting enough, it's dynamic enough, it's colorful enough to be drawn in by that. But for me, an extra dimension certainly comes from having a familiarity with its history.
So even the minor leagues now have some guarantees in terms of, salaries for players. I mean, it's great for the players. But what does it do, say, Andrew, to the enjoyment of the game? Say, you know, at a local level, for example, if you're at your local field, it seems that the tentacles of Major League Baseball seem to try to reach down to the corner field or, you know, the place in the neighborhood where we go to watch the kids play.
Yeah, it's spreading for sure. There is an effort afoot to kind of standardize everything, which, you know, has its... And certainly if you're a guy, you know, plying your trade in single A, you're probably grateful for the fact that this movement has also resulted in, you know, standards relating to player facilities and pay that didn't exist until quite recently. But there's also the risk that we are kind of turning something that used to have a lot of local character, a lot of local flavor, and a kind of an appealing element of hucksterism to it, you know, that's all been kind of ironed out of the game, I think, for better and for worse. You know, there's less flavor to the experience, I think. It's still there. There's still elements of it, but it's not as... It doesn't feel as local as it used to.
Yeah, there are a lot of memorable characters in the book, but one of them is Bill Veeck.
Veeck,
pardon me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A guy like that couldn't own a team today, could he?
He couldn't, no. And I mean, I think primarily the considerations are financial, but I mean, Veeck was also, by the end of his time in the early 80s, owning at that point the Chicago White Sox, which was the umpteenth team that he'd had a financial stake in and a big role running, the other owners were kind of tired of him. So it's symbolic, I think, that he ends up selling the White Sox to a guy named Jerry Reinsdorf in 80, I'm going to forget the year, but the early to mid-80s. And Jerry Reinsdorf still owns the White Sox. And Reinsdorf made, $100 million in real estate law, I believe, was his game. And he kind of is the model for the contemporary owner now, right? I mean, in Canada, we're used to the Blue Jays, who are one of the very few corporate-owned teams, right? They're owned by Rogers Communications. Yeah. But generally, it's multi-millionaires or billionaires now who own these things. And they find it to be in their interests to run them very safely and very conservatively and with an eye always toward profit, whereas Bill Veeck, for all of his flaws and his desire to make some money at the game, absolutely wanted to make sure that the people who loved the game like he did enjoyed it. So that, I think, is something that we'll probably never see again.
Yeah, that's a kind of owner that I think a lot of fans would like. I mean, the promotions were his specialty. But at the same time, he had no pretensions about him. And yet he understood the markets in which he worked and the markets in which he owned the team. And I think in any sport nowadays, I mean, I'm talking from Vancouver, where the hockey club, I think, I think people would want an owner like that for a hockey team. I think that's what a lot of fans in baseball probably they probably don't know that because, it's a long way from the 80s now, but I think it's something that they'd like, right?
I think so, but I mean, it also came with, for all the Bill Veecks of the world, there were also the Harold Ballards of the world, right? So I think it's a double-edged sword. I'm not here to say that everything was better back then, but certainly, as I said, some of the character has been leached from the game as a result.
I had to chuckle at one of the stories in the book where you talk about, say, a ticket to the game would be 10 cents, but parking for a horse and one buggy was 20. I guess some of these things don't change, do they?
No, they don't. No, $50 for parking, even if you get a seat in the nosebleeds. That's it, exactly.
The essay on Chicago, I particularly enjoyed that because that's a city that I've never been to. Yet what you managed to do in that piece is not just talk about baseball, but art and architecture, the element of you and your family traveling through there. It just made me want to go there.
Well, I hope I get some residuals from the Board of Tourism in the city of Chicago. That'd be great. But yeah, I mean, that's long how I've seen traveling to a lot of these places is that, baseball is a particular interest of mine, but it's not my only interest. And it's just one more way to kind of find a window into a city that you've never visited before, or one that you have visited many times and still enjoy going to.
Could you talk to me about Kevin Curley? Was he a relative of yours, or was he a relative of your wife?
He was, yeah. He was my wife's cousin. So not related to me by blood, but, I mean, my wife, we've been married for 20 years, together for 25 years. Kevin lived out in Saskatoon. He was a member of my wife's extended Irish Catholic Canadian East Coast family, and loved baseball. And he and I had a number of exchanges over the years about baseball, and he would email me these great questions. And we, at one point, he and another cousin had a kind of a fantasy league going where we would give ourselves the freedom to draft from any player in the history of the game, and never actually kept stats. It was just kind of a fun email thread. And Kevin, like too many people, died too young of cancer. It was a quick battle, unfortunately. There's something in Kevin's story that I have found always true, and that's that an enjoyment of baseball is kind of a shorthand for the time that we love spending with the people near us. The brief story that spawned that essay was the chance to make a very, very hurried drive from here in Ontario out to Saskatoon in time for Kevin's memorial service last spring.
That was you and your wife,
home,
right?
Yes, my wife and I, yeah. And along the drive home, we had a chance to stop in St. Paul, Minnesota, to see a minor league baseball game. And, it's a reminiscence and kind of a celebration of the family aspect of baseball that I love so much.
It's such a beautiful essay because it invoked in me a lot of feelings as I was reading it. And you say something so profound in it, that the reason we attend memorial services aren't all different from, say, attending a baseball game, mm-hmm. That you go to connect and affirm your place in a group. Mm-hmm. And for you, that moment in Minnesota mm-hmm. provided you such great comfort. I think you needed it at that point. And maybe you knew that already, but it just drove it home again for you, didn't it?
It absolutely did, yeah. It's the safety of finding yourself surrounded by people who share something, whether that's a name or a love or a desire to be in family and community, or people who, you know, feel as strongly about a game, as I do about baseball, and would be willing to sit on a cold, rainy night in April in St. Paul, Minnesota, and watch two minor league teams.
Yeah. The title essay in the collection, you describe, I guess, this afternoon or early evening, as you and another parent organize and arrange the field for an evening game for your kids. Did you do that regularly?
Yeah, we would have to. The field I'm describing there is the one that the local team here, we moved, you know, as the kids get older, they move to the bigger field, the full 90-foot base pass, mm-hmm. as you'd find at a game, in Toronto or whatever, at the Rogers Centre. So, yeah, it falls to, the city does kind of a baseline amount of maintenance, but it falls to the people on the team, in this case the coach, and any parents who happen to have shown up early enough to make sure the field's in game shape before the other team arrives and you start games on it. So, but I find the practice, extremely enjoyable. It might be 38 degrees outside and with horrible humidity with the sun beating down on you, but there's something enjoyable about tending to the physical requirements of the field before the players get out there and get to tear it up. So, and I found the thing, without laboring too much, I think I found the thing a good metaphor for what your job is as somebody coaching youth sports, youth baseball in particular in this case, but that's to, prepare things so that good things can then happen.
Can you quantify, I don't know how old your kids are now, but what they've gained, say, from playing baseball as they have over the years?
I think the biggest thing that you gain from team sports in general is the awareness of how to be a teammate, you want your kid to figure out, you want them to learn and begin to understand, why it's important to hit the cutoff man, or why with, when you're hitting with a runner on first and one out, you need to move him over and things like that. But more broadly, I think it's about accepting the sense of responsibility that comes from being a member of a team and enjoying that sense of community and camaraderie that come with it.
Yeah, there are a lot of mornings or drives to places where they don't want to, say, go that day, but you as parents insist on it, don't you, because they've made that commitment early on.
Yeah, that's it. That's what we've always said. You don't have to sign up next year, but you've signed up this year, so you're going to see it through, and that means showing up to every practice and every game and every event. So, yeah, and that means that we are, in our case, driving all over the eastern half of the greater Toronto area, basically.
Why is it that there were so many baseball movies made in the 1980s and into the early 90s?
For one thing, Hollywood likes to say it's bad. It likes something that's been proven to work by somebody else already. But I think also, as I argue in that essay about Bull Durham, that baseball is the ultimate, as you suggested earlier, the ultimate kind of vehicle for nostalgia, certainly for a certain generation of people. And that sort of prime generation of people for whom that was the case was the baby boomers, who were the ones at the reins of movie studios in Hollywood by the early 1980s. So they started making movies that alluded to their childhoods and made them feel good, and that meant baseball, which was a boon for those of us who are baseball fans, and probably not so much for people who weren't.
Yeah, there are a lot of good movies from that era. I mean, if you want to think about, the top 10 baseball movies ever, I think a lot of them would be from that era, wouldn't they?
It would be weighted, I think, toward that, for sure.
And then a lot of the, say, not so good, but still enjoyable. Like the, is Major League, is that the one with Bob Uecker in it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or there were two Major Leagues, I think, right?
And I think they made a third direct-to-video one as well. But yeah, there were at least two,
yeah. They're not great. Like, the first one was not a great movie, but, I mean, it is enjoyable just to watch for him.
It's a pretty good time, yeah.
And but Bull Durham, that ranks number one for you, does it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, as I say in that essay, it just got the right mix of, you know, so many of the baseball movies of the 1980s were kind of overly nostalgic and a little bit leaned a little bit too heavily on the lyric, you know, the magical realism of it all and the beauty of the game and all that. Bull Durham allows for that, but yeah. It primarily resorts to a kind of well-earned cynicism. And I say well-earned because the guy who wrote it and directed it, Ron Shelton, had spent time in the minors as a ball player, and so, you know, he'd seen it firsthand and he knew it wasn't all about guys delivering flowery speeches about the beauty of the game. It was about people struggling to hang on.
Yeah, it makes me want to. I can't. It's another essay in the book that makes me want. You know, I want to go and watch that again. I watched it a few years ago, probably five, 6 years ago, and I liked it. But unfortunately, it's one of those things where I forgot a lot about it, and you remind us of things that makes me want to go see it. One that I liked growing up was The Pride of the Yankees. Overly nostalgic, but I saw it at a young age, probably it was 10 or something like that, and that's always stayed with me.
Yeah.
And if I see it on TCM, I'll watch it, you know what I mean? I'll sit in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I love, you know, I mean, even bad baseball movies, frankly, I enjoy, like, you know, I mean, love Jackie Robinson and everything he did for the game and everything that he was as a human being, but he starred in his own Jackie Robinson story, and probably shouldn't have. But yeah, no, I love a baseball movie, and probably forgive them more faults than I would movies that aren't set on the diamond.
And faults that you know, because sometimes the play that they're depicting may not be accurate, even, right?
Yeah, there's an interesting argument to be made. You know, that there's baseball movies that put actors on the diamond, and baseball movies that put ball players on the diamond and let them act. And, you know, in Bull Durham, a lot of the guys who aren't Tim Robbins or Kevin Costner are actual minor league ball players. So the quality is pretty good.
Yeah.
And Kevin Costner can actually swing a bat. But there are definitely other movies where, you know, the people doing the things on screen pretending to be ball players have no business doing it.
Andrew, I could talk all morning with you. This is such a beautiful collection. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. Congratulations and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and your interest.
The website for more is at andrewgforbes.com. The book is called Fieldwork on Baseball and Making a Living. It's published by Assembly Press. Its author, Andrew Forbes. Join me on the line from Peterborough, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.